Sometimes people get confused when we talk of Buddhahood as a state where that we want to attain for the benefit of ourselves and others. Or they get confused when they hear that in Buddhahood we fulfill our own purpose and fulfill the purpose of others. Because somehow growing up in a Christian society, we often have the idea that we're not being completely altruistic unless we're ignoring ourselves, abnegating ourselves, and torturing ourselves. And if we have the slightest bit of happiness, it means we're being selfish. Wrong. Okay? Now we've received this subtle kind of, or gross kind of conditioning, depends on the circumstance. But from the Buddhist viewpoint, this has nothing to do with the Buddhist perspective. Okay? Because in Buddhahood, we're working for the benefit of ourselves and others. We're working for the benefit of all sentient beings. So all means all. It doesn't mean everybody else except us. It doesn't mean we torture ourselves and beat ourselves up and ignore ourselves and put ourselves down in order to feel that we're holy and pure. Come on. You know, we've been doing that all by ourselves. We don't need to learn a spiritual tradition that teaches us to, you know, get down on ourselves even more. Okay. So when we talk about Buddhahood fulfilling the purpose of self and others, it fulfills the purpose of self when we attain the Buddha's mind. Because the Buddha's mind is the Buddha's mind. It's through the Buddha's mind that the Dharma gets communicated. But sentient beings can't perceive the Buddha's mind nakedly themselves. Okay? So the Buddha's mind is the fulfillment of our own purpose, the omniscient mind. The true cessations and emptiness of that mind are the fulfillment of our own purpose of removing all the afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. At the same time that a Buddha attains a Buddha's mind, they attain a Buddha's body, okay, a form body. And there's different kinds of form bodies, but the purpose of the form bodies are to communicate the Dharma to sentient beings. So there's a resource body that communicates the Dharma to the high bodhisattvas, the Arya bodhisattvas in the Pure Land, and emanation bodies that communicate the Dharma to gross sentient beings like us. So the form bodies of a Buddha are considered fulfilling the purpose of others because they're what a Buddha uses to communicate with other sentient beings. If the Buddha didn't fulfill their own purpose and have a Buddha's mind, they wouldn't also have the Buddha's body, because the two are actualized simultaneous. It's because of having that extreme state of mental purity that then the resource body and emanation bodies can manifest from a Buddha's mind. Yeah? So fulfilling self-purpose and other purpose is very important to fulfill either purpose. Okay? And it's impossible to attain one without attaining the other. And so similarly on the path, it's very important that we work for our own benefit as well as for others' benefit. But what we need to do is understand what working for our own benefit means. Because right now, in our quite deluded state, we think we're working for our own benefit, but actually we're working for our own suffering and demise. Mm-hmm. There's the saying that sentient beings want happiness and don't want suffering, but the way we act, it's as if we're going about creating all the causes of suffering all the time. Okay? So we don't really, in our present state, know what being compassionate for ourselves means. And we don't really know what it means to be kind to ourselves and to act in our own self-interest. Yeah. So, acting in our own self-interest is different than being self-centered and selfish. When we're self-centered, when we're self-preoccupied, when we're selfish, we aren't acting in our own best interest. Because when the self-centered thought is running the show, we commit all sorts of negative karma, and our mind is filled with tons of different disturbing attitudes and negative emotions. And none of these things, either the mental afflictions nor the you know, tainted karma, none of these things are in our own best interest, because all of these things just keep us revolving in cyclic existence more and more and more. When we're thinking about our own best interest, when we're really wishing ourselves well, then we have the mind that wants to be free of cyclic existence. Yeah, so when we talk about the three principal aspects of the path, the renunciation and the determination to be free, bodhicitta and the correct view, that first one, renunciation, is the determination to be free, means having compassion for ourselves. It means working in our own best interest to try and get ourselves out of samsara. But we're not just trying to get ourselves out of cyclic existence solely for ourselves, but we're trying to do it so that we'll have the capacity to be of greater and greater benefit to all living beings. Okay? So we have to get over this mind that sees working for self and working for others as contradictory. You know, and that if others benefit, well, I can't benefit. And if I benefit, then others can't benefit. Because if we really have a big mind and a proper understanding, we get it that Dharma benefits both self and others at the same time. But here we're not talking about worldly benefit. We're not talking about the benefit of praise and good reputation and popularity and lots of people telling us they love us. We're not talking about the benefit of having riches and wealth and pleasant things and nice music and good odors and great food and, you know, a wonderful environment. We're not talking about that as being in our best interest, because attachment to those things, there's nothing wrong with them. They're just neutral in and of themselves. But when we get attached to them, that attachment is not in our best interest. And that attachment is what then creates the anger, that creates the negative karma that keeps us revolving in cyclic consistence. Okay. Are you getting what I'm saying here? This is really something that's quite important. Because otherwise if we bring our old, you know, Christian or Judaic or Islamic way of looking at things into stuff, we can get very, very confused. Because when the teachings talk about the disadvantages of self-centeredness, we have to recognize that self-centeredness is not our essence. It's not who we are. Okay, it's something that can be removed from the mind. When we don't recognize that, and we hear the disadvantages of self-centeredness, then we think, I'm bad because I'm so selfish. And then we feel guilty, and then we beat ourselves up, and we do that whole thing that we've been doing all along, which doesn't get us anywhere. Yeah? So when we feel guilty, we are not practicing the path. When we feel regret for our negative actions, we are. But there's a difference between regret and guilt. Okay? This is really very, very important. So when we do negative actions, we regret them because they harmed others and because they harm ourselves. Okay? Because we're the main recipient of the pain from our own negative actions, because the karma ripens on us, doesn't ripen on the other person. Okay? so we want to have regret for our own negative actions, but feeling guilty isn't regret. Yeah, feeling guilty is just sitting there having low self-esteem, telling ourselves we're helpless and we're hopeless, and actually it's very inflated, because when we feel guilty, the theme line behind that is, I'm so terrible, I can make everything go wrong. Isn't that a bit self-inflated? That we're so powerful, we can make everything go wrong? That's pretty conceited, isn't it? You know, I'm so powerful, I can botch everything up. Rubbish. Yeah, things are dependent on many, many factors. So this guilty mind that is just spinning around me, that's not Dharma practice. Okay? So we want to work in our own best interest without being selfish, to regret our negativities without feeling guilty. Yeah? These things go together. But we really have to understand what they mean. And then identify the corresponding mental states inside of our own heart, so we can differentiate when we're feeling regret versus when we feel guilty, and when we're being selfish versus when we're working for our own actual self-interest, which means working for the interest of others. Okay? Because if we're really working for our own best interest, then we try and benefit others. Because when we benefit others, we benefit. Okay, you're going to go, what's he talking about? When I benefit others, I lose out. I don't get anything. Well, it's what we were talking about yesterday. You know, if we're generous, we receive the good karma from generosity. We receive the delight of feeling generous. We receive the absence of fear and regret at the time of death because of being generous in our lifetime. Yeah, that's how we benefit from being generous. The other person just gets some object or, you know, some few words or something like that. Okay? So we really have to change our mind around about what it means to receive benefit. So this is what's meant by thought training. We really have to train our way of thinking so that we see things in a different way. Also, you know, how do we receive benefit by benefiting others? We'll put it this way. If we don't benefit others, then others live in miserable conditions, which means we live in a family with other people who are miserable, or we live in a neighborhood with other people who are miserable. We live in a country with other people who are miserable. We live in a world with miserable people. How do we feel when we live in a place with miserable people? Does that make us happy? Is that conducive for our own happiness? Do you like living near miserable people? You ever lived with somebody who's very depressed? It's awful, isn't it? Yeah? Hello out there? Yeah? Isn't it awful if you live with somebody who's depressed? They're suffering, but you're miserable as well living with them. Yeah? And if you live in a society full of people who are poor, people who are miserable, are you happy? Do you feel safe? When I go to Latin America, it's incredible. The rich neighborhoods there, yeah, everybody has these incredible gates in front of their houses. They have barbed wire around the top. They have guards. They live in what looks like a prison out of fear of the poor people stealing their stuff. Is that happiness? When you live out of fear of other people stealing your stuff? Yeah? Doesn't all that stuff create suffering at that point? So we see that if we live in a place where the people around us are miserable, it's hard for us to be happy. Whereas if we take care of others, then it becomes possible for them to be happy, which makes our whole life, our own life, a lot nicer. Okay. Now, there's another important point here. Working for others' benefit does not mean that we are capable of fixing all their problems. Okay. If you're living with somebody that's depressed, you might work for their benefit. That doesn't mean that their depression is your responsibility and that if they remain depressed, you failed. Yeah. Because we can't control other people's minds, can we? But we certainly can be kind and be of benefit. And sometimes being of benefit means giving people a kick in the pants. Any parent knows that. Don't you know that, parents? How many of you are parents? Any of you are parents? You know sometimes you have to give your kid a kick in the pants. Yeah? And that's kindness. Because if you don't do it, they're going to be a total misfit and not be able to function in society because they can never hear the answer no. And they don't know how to deal with their own frustration of not getting what they want. Yeah? So sometimes as a parent, the kindest thing you do to your kid is say, I know you want that, but I'm sorry we can't get that. And then not feel at all guilty about it. Because a parent's responsibility is not to give the kid everything they want. It's to give the kid the tools for how to deal with life. And part of dealing with life is knowing how to be happy when you can't get everything you want. Yeah. So as a parent, you have to teach that to your kids. Yeah. And you have to model that in your own life. That's which is much harder than teaching it to your kids. So to really be a good parent, you have to grow up yourself. Hard, isn't it? Yeah, it's hard being a parent. Yeah, I got out of that one. Okay, so, you know, if we benefit others, then we ourselves are happy because we live together with people who are happier. Yeah. And because when we benefit others, then we don't suffer from guilt. Because we know that we've acted from kindness. Whether or not somebody else has received our kindness, we cannot control. But we have to act with kindness. And it's the same with the generosity, that example that I was talking about yesterday. Our job is to act generous. Whether other people receive it or not, we have no power or control. Whether they appreciate it, whether they praise us, whether they think we're wonderful, or sometimes we're generous and they swear at us. Yeah. We had an interesting thing just happen a couple of weeks ago at the Abbey. One of the nuns was working with one laywoman and noticed that they were working together, and she noticed that the laywoman really liked this one picture of the Buddha, and so the nun gave it to her. And the woman got very upset. She got really angry and then said, I don't trust you anymore, and refused to take it. I don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand how her mind was thinking. But, you know, an interesting example, isn't it, of sometimes you try to be generous and the person gets mad at you. And sometimes we try and be kind and the person gets mad at us. Does that mean that we failed in our act of kindness or our act of generosity? No. No. You know, we did what we could. We cannot control other than living beings. Okay? Has it ever happened to you where you've been kind and somebody else has thrown a pie in your face? Have we ever done that to others? Oh no, we wouldn't do that. We just live in a world of people who do that to us. But we're never ungrateful, are we? Okay, let's get back to our text here. So we're still talking about the benefits of generosity, remember? The qualities gained on account of giving are wealth. Okay, it's karmically, giving creates the cause to receive wealth. Nobility, yeah, meaning you become like an Arya, become a wise person. And bliss, because when you give, you feel bliss. And this is how we have to train our mind, so that when we give, we feel delight. They say that the bodhisattvas, those beings who have the stable bodhicitta, when they hear somebody saying, give me, they just feel so much bliss and so much excitement, because then they get to practice generosity. We hear somebody say, give me, and we go, oh, leave me alone already. And this is the difference between an ordinary being and a bodhisattva. And why bodhisattvas have so much bliss, and we, in spite of looking out for ourselves, don't feel so much bliss. Okay? Those who uphold the ethical precepts succeed in being reborn in the celestial realms, because ethical conduct is the cause of good rebirth. Okay, so generosity is the cause of wealth in a future life. Ethical conduct is the cause of good rebirth. Actually, generosity isn't only the cause of wealth in future lives. I had quite an interesting experience regarding this. In the first years of my ordination, I was quite poor. I think I told you that I was living in India, you know, because we didn't have monasteries for Western Sangha in those days. So I was living in India with $50 to my name and rationing my toilet paper and so on. Then I went to live in France, and the nuns were living in the horse stables. And so it was quite cold in the winter, like really cold. It was good for motivating you to do prostrations, but not necessarily was a good motivation to do prostrations. You had to remember, I'm not just bowing to keep warm, I'm bowing to purify. But it was pretty cold. So at one point, I remember sitting myself down and really saying, you know, because we had to pay for our own heat, and I didn't have any money to pay for heat. So just sitting down with myself and saying, you know, children, your poverty is because of your own stinginess. You know, if you really believe in what the teachings are saying, this is what they've been saying all along, you know, that when you're poor, it's because you're stingy, so you have to start giving. Yeah. And so I started giving myself, not just a nudge, I had to really, you know, push myself sometimes, because the stinginess, the miserliness, the attachment were so strong. But then, you know, when you start giving, then it's amazing how things turn around. Yeah? It's just amazing how karmically that works even within this lifetime. Okay, through meditation and wisdom, one's mind becomes pure and free of defiling attachment. Okay, so through meditation and concentration, we free the mind temporarily from the gross attachment and afflictions. Through the wisdom realizing emptiness, we can cut the root of all the afflictions. Thus one is bound to gain the path to nirvana. The blessings gained as a result of giving serve as one's provisions as one travels along that road to nirvana. Okay. So from here to nirvana, to enlightenment, it's probably going to take us some lifetimes to do. Okay? They say aim for Buddhahood in this life, but don't expect it. So it's probably going to take us some time to do that. So what we want to have between now and when we attain full enlightenment is a series of good rebirths that have all the conducive circumstances that enable us to practice. Because if we're born in a situation in the hellish world as a hungry ghost, as an animal, as a human being who has certain obstacles or lives in a place where there's no religious freedom or doesn't have any faith, you know, in their heart, you know, human beings with so many different obstacles, then we don't have the chance to practice the Dharma. And one of the obstacles is, even if we're born as a human being, being impoverished. It becomes, you know, you can still practice, but it becomes more difficult to practice when you're impoverished. When we practice generosity, it creates the causes so that, you know, in the future when we're practicing Dharma, we have enough wherewithal to be able to do our practice. We aren't starving. We aren't in the middle of a war-torn country where there's famine and drought. Yeah. But we have a situation like we have now where we, you know, we have the material wherewithal to be able to practice the Dharma. So, you know, generosity is important in that respect, and that's why it says that the blessings gained as a result of giving serve as one's provisions as one travels along the road to nirvana. Okay? So giving of material things creates the cause to receive material things. Giving the Dharma creates the cause to receive the Dharma. Yeah. If we're stingy in terms of sharing the Dharma, it creates an obstacle for us to meeting the Dharma in the future lives. Now you might say, well, I don't have the ability to give the Dharma, you know, I don't know anything, or certainly not enough. Well, part of giving the Dharma could be sharing a book, or it could be inviting your friend to come along to a Dharma talk with you, or it could be reciting mantras and some of the prayers and the different texts out loud so even your pets hear them and the birds hear them and the insects hear them. That's also considered giving the Dharma. Or if you're in the hospital with a sick or dying relative, saying the mantra or, again, reading different scriptures out loud so that person hears them, even if they're unconscious, it plants good seeds in their mind stream. So that's also considered giving the Dharma. Okay, many ways to give the Dharma. In Southeast Asia, there's a custom of making donations in order to print Dharma books for free distribution. That's another way of giving the Dharma. It's a really nice custom because then everybody has access to Dharma books. Okay. Similarly, you know, we're going to need encouragement and we're going to need kind words on our path to enlightenment. Yeah. So by giving encouragement and support to other people in this lifetime, we're creating the cause to receive that in the future lifetime. Yeah. If you want to be a bodhisattva, yeah, or, you know, when we become bodhisattvas, we also need a group of people around us who are going to help us in all of our virtuous practice, our virtuous activities. Yeah, we might have incredible bodhicitta and want to benefit a lot of people, but if there's not a group of people around us who will help us carry out our ideas, we won't be able to do that. Yeah, and so now, in our ordinary state, when we offer service, you know, when we offer our time, we're helping to create the cause for others then to offer service and offer their time when we're bodhisattvas, so that we can continue to do things that benefit other sentient beings and continue to create merit. Okay? Getting what I'm talking about? Okay. When one brings giving to mind, one experiences delight. Yeah, that's how a bodhisattva feels. They think of giving, feel so happy. And this is, when we do the giving and taking meditation, when we imagine giving, to really create that feeling of happiness, just imagining giving to other people. Yeah, it's a very powerful practice. Even we may not have the material wherewithal to give, just to imagine transforming our possessions and our body and our everything else, and giving it to others, and thereby developing that delight in giving. It's a very powerful practice. On account of delight, this is a very interesting thing. When one brings giving to mind, one experiences delight. Okay? On account of delight, one develops unity of mind. Okay? Unity of mind means samadhi, because samadhi unifies the mind on a single point. So what's a precursor to samadhi? It's delight. It's rapture. It's bliss. Yeah? So those things help and aid the samadhi, or the unity of the mind. With unity of mind, one proceeds to contemplate birth, death, and impermanence. So with that samadhi, that deep concentration, we then engage in insight meditation that contemplates birth, death, and impermanence. So contemplating the three characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, the dukkha or dissatisfactory conditions of birth and death, and then selflessness. None of the aggregates are the self. And the self is none of the aggregates. Because one contemplates birth, death, and impermanence, one becomes able to gain realization of the path. So through developing insight into the nature of reality, we gain the path realizations, through which we then free our mind and develop the capacity to be of greatest benefit to others. So the beginning of the series, we go backwards, okay, to have nirvana or enlightenment, we need to gain realizations of the path. That depends on insight meditation, knowing the three characteristics, and especially selflessness and emptiness. That depends on having unity of mind or concentration. That depends on experiencing delight. And delight depends on being generous. Okay? You see the connection there? This is comparable to when a person plants trees out of a desire to have shade, or else plants trees because he seeks their blossoms or seeks their fruit. The aspiration for a reward in the practice of giving is just like this. The bliss acquired in this and future lives is comparable to the shade sought from planting trees. So the immediate good effect while we're still in samsara is having the bliss in this and future lives. So that's like planting the trees in order to get the shade. Because the shade is the first thing you get, isn't it? Okay. The paths of the hearers and solitary realizers, those are beings who are practicing to attain liberation, are akin to their blossoms. So after the shade, when the tree grows, you get the blossoms. So not only do we receive benefit in this life, but for the hearers and solitary realizers, they attain liberation. But as bodhisattvas, we're not hooked on that. Okay? The realization of Buddhahood, that's what we want. The realization of Buddhahood is analogous to their fruits. So after the blossoms comes the fruits. Yeah? So we're aiming for full Buddhahood with the capacity to benefit others and ourselves. These are the various sorts of meritorious qualities associated with generosity. So that's talking about the benefits of generosity. Any questions so far? Yeah.
Can you explain why the light would be the precursor to the light? Isn't it if you're colored and you have the light, you're totally dead?
Yeah. I think to light here, there's a little bit of a... my guess is, I don't know the Chinese words translated from Chinese, but very often in this series, it's rapture, because or bliss, because when you're attaining the jhanas, the dhyanas, yeah, not princess, yeah, but dhyana, yeah, that which is the same, that's the Sanskrit word for Pali, and that's the Chinese word is chan, the Japanese word is zen, okay. When you're attaining those meditative stabilizations, in the first two, you know, there's four meditative stabilizations. In the first two, then the factors of rapture and bliss are quite important and are very prominent. Okay, and so actually, just getting yourself from not having serenity, shamatha, to having serenity, then you're really developing those qualities of rapture and bliss, and they bring unity to the mind, because you're right there, you're not off on the all over the universe, and because it kind of it strengthens the concentration. Yeah. But eventually, actually, as you're going through the jhanas and refining them, going through the different stages of those four meditative stabilizations, at a certain point you do leave behind the rapture and you leave behind the bliss. Aim for equanimity, because they say that that is more satisfactory. So here, actually, when it's talking about generosity creating delight, that delight isn't the same exact same kind of delight as you're going to have when you're generating the serenity, when you're doing shamatha meditation, but it's still somewhere in that same group of feelings. So it's helping to make the mind more delighted, which does help concentration. Is that okay? Anything else? We start off the next section. Okay. So this is called the characteristics and import of generosity. So the first part here is three definitions of generosity. So there's a question: what is meant by giving? What is meant by generosity? Okay, generosity refers to an instance of giving wherein there is a corresponding instance of wholesome intentionality. This is what is meant by generosity. So that's one definition. Okay, let's unpack this. It refers to an instance of giving, yeah, wherein, so it's not just the verbal and physical giving, it's not just the mental imagining of giving. Yeah, that alone isn't generosity, because it's an instance of giving wherein there is a corresponding instance of wholesome intentionality. In other words, to practice generosity, we have to have wholesome intentionality. If we have the intention to hurt somebody by giving them something, that's not generosity. Okay. Wholesome intentionality. Yeah, intentionality there. The Sanskrit word is chetana. It is one of the mental factors of intention, and that is the mental factor that can also be known as karma. Okay? So that's how generosity becomes an action, a karma, because there's the mental factor of intention. that is wholesome. Yeah, which means that it is accompanied by another mental factor, such as kindness, compassion, you know, love, some other kind of mental factor that's a wholesome or virtuous mental factor, that makes the mental factor of intention virtuous. And that mental factor is the mental karma. And then when we act verbally and physically, those are the physical and verbal karmas that are motivated by the mind. Okay, are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? For the body and speech to move and act, there has to be a mental intention. The mind always comes first. Then the mouth moves. Then the body moves. These things don't happen by accident. They happen through intentionality. Okay, sometimes it seems like they happen by accident. Yeah, we're in the middle of saying something and going, I should not be saying this. Yeah, it seems like there's no intention to say what we say, but actually there is an intention, otherwise it wouldn't be coming out of our mouth. Because nobody else is moving our mouth but our own intention. Okay, nobody else is moving our body but our own intention. So everything originates with the mind. That's why generosity, you know, to be virtuous, has to have a virtuous intention behind it. Yeah? Just giving itself is, you know, like I was saying, some people say Iran is very generous. Yeah? Or they might say, you know, a suicide bomber gave his life. Yeah, is that generosity? Yeah, is being a suicide bomber for your political cause generosity? Hello? Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think, you know, when the Buddha talks of giving giving your body for benefit of sentient beings, there's never one instance in the scriptures of a suicide bomber. Okay? Not a single one. But some people may say, but that's generosity, they're giving their body. But what kind of motivation is there behind being a suicide bomber? There's anger and resentment, isn't there? And there's wrong views. So all those kinds of things don't set for a positive intention. Yeah, they become an unwholesome intention. Even if the person themselves thinks that they're doing the right thing. Yeah, communicating? Yeah, because lots of times we think we're doing the right thing, we think we're doing something noble, but it's actually wrong views that are operating in our mind. It was quite interesting. One time when I was in Israel, my friends, because I was there teaching Dharma to Israelis, they were taking me around, and we went outside of Haifa. There was this old prison where the British used to imprison, you know, because the British monks had the mandate there, and they imprisoned all these people who were criminals and who were political prisoners. And it was really kind of a ghastly place. They even had a room where there was a gallows, and they really. But on the wall, they had all these stories of these, you know, Israeli patriots who did all these things that eventually convinced Britain to leave Palestine, and that led to the creation of the State of Israel. And I was reading the stories of what these people did, and there was one of them I remember who, you know, kind of there was a bus going along, and he hijacked the bus, and he did this and that, and somebody else blew up a hotel and things like this. And I said to my Israeli friends, I said, these people were terrorists. And they said, no, they were patriots. Okay? So whether, you know, you're a patriot or a terrorist, it depends who's looking at the situation. Yeah? But if you look at the situation, regardless of your political preference, through the perspective of what kind of karma somebody is creating due to their own intentionality, due to their own motivation, yeah, then you see that even if somebody thinks that they're doing something good, if their mind is filled with wrong views and confusion, they aren't necessarily doing that. Okay. Like people who do animal sacrifice, yeah, to please the gods, they think they're doing something virtuous. Is it virtuous to kill an animal? No. Okay. Then there's another definition of generosity. There are those who say that the arising of physical and verbal actions following from wholesome intentionality may also qualify as dana. So that's the same kind of thing. So the physical and verbal actions that follow from a virtuous intention to give, that is generosity. There are others who say that generosity refers to the coming together of three factors: faith, a field of blessings, and a material object, all simultaneous with the mind's generating a dharma of relinquishing capable of destroying miserliness. Okay. Remember before we had the thing yesterday, a field of blessings, and the right time, and then one's own intentionality. Yeah. So this is similar to that, except here it adds faith. So I think faith here means faith in the efficaciousness of generosity. Yeah, a field of blessing meaning the object, the person, the recipient that we give to. A material object, here it's talking about material, but it could be kind words, it could be the Dharma, could be love or protection. Okay. And all of these things are simultaneous with the mind generating a mental factor of relinquishing, a mental factor relinquishing, okay? Giving up, not grasping. So a mental factor of relinquishing capable of destroying miserliness. So a mental factor of giving up clinging that is capable, that is analogous to destroying miserliness. Okay? Is that making some sense? You getting what I'm saying? That, in other words, for it to be generosity, it has to be free of miserliness. Yeah, to be free of miserliness, we have to relinquish clinging. We have to relinquish the miserliness. And through that, then we have a good intention. Just as with the Dharma of kindness, which is Maitri in Sanskrit, wherein on contemplating what brings happiness to beings, one's mind then generates kindness, so too it is with dana, another of the mental factors associated with the mind. These three factors come together and the mind then generates a mental factor of relinquishing capable of destroying miserliness. These three factors come together: faith, field of blessings, material object, and then the mind generates a mental factor of relinquishing that's capable of destroying miserliness. Okay? So it's really emphasizing that miserliness, that generosity is totally free from miserliness, and which means that it's giving without a sense of fear, giving without a sense of poverty. You know, in when we do the mandala offering, there's a phrase. What's the phrase? Without.
Without fear of loss.
Yeah,
without fear of loss.
Yeah, without fear of loss, without fear of poverty. Okay? So So it's a mind. If we give, but at the same time we're afraid of losing, we're afraid that if I give, I won't have, then the mind's not being totally generous. Okay? Because the mind is operating from a state of poverty, feeling that there's not enough, feeling that mind doesn't have complete faith in the benefits of generosity. Does it? Because it's saying, if I give, I won't have, and this material object is the thing that's really the most important. Not, you know, the virtue of generosity being the most important, but the material object is the most important. So that mind has that fear of poverty, and it has that fear of loss. Yeah, so there's still some miserliness there. So they're all, you know, has to be a thing of really relinquishing the miserliness, putting it down, so that there's no fear of losing anything. Because if there's fear of losing things, we don't feel delight in giving, do we? Yeah? So we have to rid ourselves of that fear of loss, that feeling of losing when we're giving, and instead replace it with a feeling of gaining when we're giving. And this is where I think the motivation is so important, because when we really think of the benefits of giving and we think of the benefits for ourselves but also the benefits for the other and the expansiveness of the giving that we're doing, how if we benefit that person and they benefit another and so on and so on and so on, then we feel very inspired by giving, and that inspiration makes the mind quite delighted and happy. Okay? So it's sometimes hard, isn't it? Sometimes hard. I hold on to my little container. You know? It's like I get done, you know, there's a little round container like this of incense, and I got done offering all the incense to the Buddha. It's like, but this container is useful. I can't throw it out. So I brought it into the abbey and, you know, turned it into a pencil holder. But at least then I gave it away. I didn't keep it in my room under the bed for 10 years. Okay. In general, I have a policy that if I have gone a year without using something, then it's time to give it away. Yeah. And actually, being a nun is quite helpful in that respect, because we're only allowed to have 13 things that we consider our own. Yeah. Everything else that we have in our room is the property of the abbey. Yeah. So, you know, your clothes you can consider your own, your three robes, your bowl. But everything else you consider the property of the monastery. So that's good in that respect. Yeah. But sometimes you have to remind yourself of it. Mm-hmm. Especially when you have to switch rooms. Or, I want to take my blanket. Well, it's not your blanket. Remember? You're practicing giving up attachment. Okay. Let's just sit quietly for a couple of minutes before we dedicate.